All right, so Raim Tovim, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome. It is 1:30 or 7:30 in Israel. I want to welcome everybody to a visual tour of the Haggadah. We're pleased to have Adam Cohen, and I'm Dr. Adam Cohen, who teaches at University of Toronto Art History. And this is the book published in 2018, I believe, by Koren, hundreds of pictures and manuscripts of the Haggadah, and obviously a professor of art history. And Dr. Cohen also serves as the president of the historic Kibbutz Shul in downtown Toronto, where the community first began. I live in the suburbs, as most people do, but there is a community still in the downtown area. And it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Cohen here for his debut on Zoom for Torah in Motion. I think hopefully a most appropriate topic as we head in the final stretch before Pesach. Bakasha, Dr. Cohen.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. I have to say that as someone who has had the schus to be a participant listening to so many of the shiurim and the wonderful programs that Torah in Motion puts on, to now be called up to the major leagues and to join the roster, if only for one day, is just a tremendous honor. And I know from attending these events that the crowds that you attract are very experienced, very learned, and I hope that what I have to share today will be of value to people. Obviously, we're in the days right up, running into Pesach, and Passover is such a rich holiday, and the Seder and the Haggadah, and there's so much to say, and no one lecture, drush, can do it all. So I simply want to offer you, in the time we have together, some insights based on my perspective as a art historian. Let me call up the here we go. It's always that moment of truth. You never know when, if and when the screen will actually share. Baruch Hashem. Okay. So here indeed is the name of the book. You'll forgive me for shilling right at the top, but the thoughts, ideas, the material that I will share with you today come as the result of the research that I did for this book. The quick backstory is that I was trained as an art historian first at Columbia, then at Johns Hopkins, and I spent much of my early professional scholarly career looking at Christian illuminated manuscripts. Now, why a Shomer Shabbos guy would do that is a question that we can discuss with my psychologist sometime. But at a certain point in my life, I decided I wanted to take these skills and address Jewish material. And my first project was an investigation of the history of the illustrated Haggadah. Now, there are thousands, literally thousands, probably no book has been illustrated in Jewish history more often than the Haggadah. And there are all kinds of reasons for that, but we won't go into that. My book works through the history of the illustrated Haggadah from the Middle Ages, starting around the year 1300 until the present. And I think that in this way, you get a whole potpourri of things. One can trace the chronological development, but one could also think about the different themes that come out in the illustrated Haggadah. For our purposes, because we are on the eve of the Seder, what I decided to do was craft a presentation that literally walks through the Haggadah one item at a time. And it'll be a little bit of a smorgasbord because in some ways it goes against my fundamental principle of how to do history, which is to focus on one thing in its historical context and to really understand it inside and out, to really go be'iyun, and to work very hard at contextualizing things and understanding them on their own merits. This is going to be more all over the place, but I hope that the advantage to doing that will show you the absolute stunning variety of possibilities that images add to the Haggadah and potentially to your Seder experience. Now, I need to start with just a couple of introductory points before we get to the Haggadah itself. The first postulate is that pictures are not just eye candy. And I took, with all due respect to Dr. Rabbi Zev Farber, whom I do not know, I just literally went on the internet, and here on Torah.com is an essay about the four sons, one of the most beloved parts of the Haggadah. And Dr. Rabbi Zev Farber gives us a picture right up front of the four sons from Arthur Schick's famous Haggadah. And then he goes on for page after page after page, and he talks about all of the, about many of the elements of the four sons, but he never talks about the picture itself. All it is a hook to attract your attention and get you in and convince you to read the rest of the article. Now, serving as a hook, drawing in your eye, is certainly one of the things that pictures do, but as I hope you'll see, it's not the only thing that they do. So postulate one, pictures are not just what I call eye candy. Postulate number two. Here are the exact same pages from two versions of the Haggadah published by the exact same publisher. And you can see there's a critical difference between the two, right? And the implication that if we had more time and if we were in person, I would make this more Socratic and ask you for, you know, call and response. But in the interest of time, I'll just plunge forward. I'm sure I know, knowing the Tim crowd, that there will be questions, there will be comments in the chat box. I'll try and follow, but I don't promise. I think you'll agree with me that the implication here is clear. Pictures are for children, right? The family Haggadah doesn't need pictures. A kid's Haggadah, nice pictures, good for kids. Now, don't get me wrong. I myself, for many years, have used the Art Scroll family Haggadah. It's very practical. It keeps everybody on the same page. But there's an unfortunate, to my mind, implication. And here again, two equivalent pages. One, let's call it a standard Haggadah. Again, I literally just lifted this one off my shelf. I didn't single it out for any reason. And the same page for Vinitzak from one with picture. And even without exploring what the picture does or the layout of the page, I hope that you'll agree with me that at the very least, the different night Haggadah with the picture offers the reader or offers the viewer additional material with which to work, that the picture does something. Right now, it's our job as viewers to think about what it is the picture does. And that's what I'm going to share with you over the next 40 some odd minutes. Many examples of the things that pictures do. One last postulate. And here I turn to the great Perush by the very important late Acharon, Gary Larson, who gives us the critical sense, for my perspective, of what art is. You know, if you had to sum it up on one foot, as it were, what Gary Larson is telling us is that artists make choices, right? That things just don't come out full-formed and appear on the easel, on the page, whatever the case may be. that somebody has to think, what is my image going to look like? And again, our job is to think through that process and try and reconstruct, to the extent that we can, what was the artist trying to tell us? And even if we can't do that, we're still entitled to look at the pictures and say, what does it mean to me? What ideas does it stimulate in my mind? Now, as a historian, I myself am more interested in trying to reconstitute the original moment of creation and meaning for the people who made and used it in the first moment. But, and this is what I always tell my students, yes, sometimes there is a wrong answer. It's not always a matter of interpretation. But to a certain degree, in fact, when one is looking at something from a culture that's very far and distant, right, it may be that we can't recover the original meaning, but we are entitled to say what it means to us. Okay, but my own interest, as I said, my focus will be more on the main, the input rather than the output. But I certainly don't want to constrain anyone from looking at things in their own way. Okay, so here we go. Here's a thought experiment. And here I am going to ask you to write in the chat box. If you were given the responsibility to illustrate a Haggadah, where would you start? Now, while you're thinking about that for a moment, I'm going to give you one piece of historical background and just remind you that for thousands of years in the Jewish experience, people had a Seder, nobody had a Haggadah. We, of course, are all used to having our own, right? We live in a privileged time. All right, the answers are starting to come in. Keep going. But our first textual evidence, when did Jews start writing down the text of the Haggadah? It's not before the 9th century. Our earliest actual fragment comes from the Cairo Geniza from the 10th century. And the earliest Haggadahs were part of a whole Siddur, an entire Machzor, and only became a separate individual thing like the one you can hold in your hands in the 13th century, right? So it's only 700 years that we have Haggadahs. Okay, so my point is that it's only around the year 1000, 1100, and really starting in 1200 that people have to start figuring out how they're going to illustrate the Haggadah. Okay, so some of the, okay, Exodus, idol worship, Maggid, family pictures. I love that, Mimi. Thank you. Seder. Now, we're going to see examples of all of this. Okay. Well, Paul, I'm not asking you to change the words. I'm asking you to add value with pictures.
Even the order.
Okay. So
I don't think I changed the order because I think some of what was being said was the order as well.
Ah, I see. Okay. Thank you for the clarification. So let me show you how one of the earliest illustrated Haggadahs chose to do it. Creation. Of course, where would you start the Haggadah? In the beginning. Bereshit bara Elokim. Right? And clearly, our artist has read the first Rashi. He knows the point about, like Rashi's point about why does the Torah itself start where it does, right? Because Hashem wants to establish his dominion over the whole world so that when it comes to Bnei Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael, he can put it, he can do with it what he wants, right? So for the artist of the Sarajevo Haggadah, the famous Sarajevo Haggadah, about which I won't say very much about its whole story, that would be an entirely different lecture, says, the story of Pesach begins at creation. And the Haggadah has page after page of pictures. The very next one after that is Adam v'Chava, Adam and Eve, Noah building the Teva, here's the Ark. And it goes page after page, pictures from Genesis, from Shemot, even going into Deuteronomy. And here is another early 14th century Haggadah from Iberia, from Sfarad, which has a similar layout to the Sarajevo Haggadah. All of the, not all of, lots of Genesis into Exodus, this, you know, Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and then Yosef. Finally, we're starting to get close to the story. And here in these two pages, you see the some of the plagues. And then here, this is right after the after Yam Suf, the splitting of the Red Sea. Here's Miriam and the other women singing. And then the very next scene is a Baal HaBayit distributing food to the people. It's matzah and charoset. And here the family is cleaning the house and they're preparing for the feast. So there's this sense that the Haggadah story and our actions are a seamless continuation of Hashem's sacred story as laid out in the Bible, and that continues uninterrupted into our own time. So, of course, it's appropriate for us. So now we've finally gotten the biblical backstory out of the way, and as the so-called Golden Haggadah tells us, pictures of people preparing for Pesach are often found in the Haggadah. I noticed when I asked how would you start the Haggadah, I don't think anyone said pictures of cleaning, right? But I also know that nobody listening is unaware of how vital the cleaning process is to preparing for the holiday. So here is just one of many examples of the people preparing. In the upper scene is the folks baking matzah, begil, bechedva, uveditzot. They're happy, they're merry, they're full of gladness that they're able to perform the mitzvah of baking the matzah. The matzah is being baked down below. Rabbi Kelman knows that this is one of my favorite parts of the history of the Illustrated Haggadah, because in the top are two boys who are sneaking a bite of the matzah before already. And Rabbi Kelman in his Daf Yomi talked about this just a couple of weeks ago. It refers to a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud in which basically it's in the Yerushalmi Psachim, where it basically says, look at these boys eating the matzah. It's like a man who consummates his marriage in the house of his father-in-law before the marriage. So don't jump the gun, which is obviously rooted in the Gemara, but also I think is a, I'll make it a little bigger just that you can get the detail a little more. On the facing page, we have, again, not so much a witticism, but real practical halacha illustrated. Here is our fellow who is engaged in bedika. The wife is brushing things out with the broom, and the captions give a gloss. And again, these come right out of Tractate Psachim, that in the courtyard, you don't need to search because the ravens are there, and we assume that they're going to eat up any stray chametz. Whereas in the cellar, you have to be more careful, all right? And that's exactly what's going on there. Right. Okay, one more case of Bedikat Chametz, the focus is clearly on Bedika. And as much as I can, what I'll try and do is juxtapose a historical example of a particular image and a more modern one. Here, the Prague Haggadah of 1526, arguably the first Haggadah printed on a printing press, although there's some scholarly debate about that, but if not the first, it's certainly among the top three. And here you can see that when it comes time to printing, the artist has reduced the scene to a very simple figure of a man holding a candle with the receptacle. Now, again, just compare. Think of the economics of the matter for a moment. We're getting off of Peirush and interpretation. Right? Here's that same guy, but he's in a house and the house has tiles and windows and so on and so forth. This is a lot more economical to just reduce the whole image of Bedikat Chametz to the figure of the man, and you can print it over and over and over again, and it doesn't cost very much money. Meanwhile, we have more recently a wonderful artist lives in Yerushalayim. Many of you likely know David Moss, who worked on a handmade, in a medieval manner, a handmade Haggadah back in 1983, which is now available in several editions. So anyone can have a copy of the Moss Haggadah, and I really do encourage it. Here, what David Moss has done, and again, I'm sorry that the images are not quite as crisp as I would like, but he reviews all of the halachot, all of the laws of matzah, and of chametz, rather, and he juxtaposes them with text from Rambam's Hilchot Matzah, from the Rambam. Right? And the pictures break down the wheat from the field to the stalk to the grain and ultimately down to the mitochondrial DNA. You know, and he's making us think about the degree to which we need to look for chametz. Okay, next, all right, we've gotten rid of all the chametz. So the next thing to do, of course, is start to prepare. We have to go shopping. Shopping was a different experience back in the Middle Ages. Everybody prepared their own. And so here we have in two examples, here's in the top corner, a husband and wife working together on the charoset. The caption says they make it in memory of the clay, nuts, apples, and pears. And, you know, for people who are interested in the history of Minhag, right, you can track the different customs of what people, for instance, used for charoset in Germany as opposed to Spain. That's not my particular my particular scholarly focus, but one could use these illustrated Haggadahs as archaeological snapshots of the particular customs in force at particular times in particular places. Down below, the caption tells us he takes the wine from the barrel, and yet the barrel is constantly empty. I think a kind of joke about the great consumption of wine during the Seder. And then in the Sarajevo Haggadah, once again, we see, like the Golden Haggadah, the distribution of charoset and matzah, which, you know, again, we, those of us who are very from, we tend to shake off our charoset before we eat, but clearly half the page is given over to charoset. It's obviously very important in the mindset of the Iberian Jews in the early 14th century. Okay, are we ready for the Seder yet? Not quite. First, if we're still in Iberia, it seems that we have a custom to recite the Haggadah in shul. And so the picture, the sister Haggadah, just a funny nickname that comes because it looks very much like the golden Haggadah, so we call it the sister Haggadah. Or is it the Rylands Haggadah? And some of these nicknames get confusing. Here, clearly, the distinguished gentleman, probably the rabbi, is reading. A couple of the people have texts in their hands, but most of the congregation is listening. And we know from the Rabbia, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yoel Halevi, who is one of the Balei Tosfos, he says that he read that in Svarad and in Bavel, they recited the Haggadah in Shul for the Amei Haaretz, for the people who didn't know how. And this may well be what we're seeing in the picture. The Abudraham around 1340 also writes about this practice, but he says it happened. So we don't know if it was still current, but certainly people go to synagogue before the Seder, and here in the Sarajevo Haggadah, a lovely picture of the Ganze Mishpacha leaving. Of course, they wouldn't be the Ganze Mishpacha in Spain, leaving the father blessing the children on the way home. So now we turn the page and we're finally ready for the Seder. I know some of you are listening. It's like the family Seder. You're saying, when are we going to get to the meal already? Right? Oh, we've got so much. We haven't even gotten to the Seder, no less the meal, but we'll get there eventually. Hang on. Okay. Now here is the, here are two, you know, and of course, I imagine that when I show some of these pictures, I would not be surprised if it stimulates you to think of equivalent examples that you know from your own experiences at the Seder. Right? So the picture on the right is the Ketav Haggadah, just the one I happen to have at hand. It's among the many that I used as a kid, right? And among the first pages is this picture of the Seder plate. But again, I'm sure you can think of other examples that you know and love better. I have to admit, I don't find this a particularly lovable picture. It communicates the necessary information, but it doesn't have any particular artistic merit. Whereas the kibbutz, the Haggadah from the kibbutz, the national kibbutz movement, HaShomer HaTzair, this one produced in 1958, I just think is a beautiful picture that not only captures my attention because of the elegance of the line and the balance of the colors, but also because of the message that it's trying to communicate, where the Seder plate has been transformed into a brilliant glowing sun. And this isn't surprising because the Haggadot made in the hundreds on kibbutzim throughout the entire history of Israel. One of the main ideas that these Haggadot tried to instill in the understanding and appreciation of the holiday was as Chag Ha'aviv, the springtime festival, which is very agricultural and makes sense on a kibbutz. And so you see these springtime themes throughout all of the Kibbutz Haggadot. And here is just one example of the glowing sun merged with the Seder plate. I find it very moving. And just by the by, I'll have other occasion to show Haggadot from the Israeli kibbutz movement. You know, they're not, I hope I'm not getting in any trouble here. They are not the kind of Haggadah that people who attend Torah in Motion events would expect to use at their own Seder. And I'm not advocating it. But one of the great revelations to me in doing the work for this book was to see the whole phenomenon of the Kibbutz Haggadah. And they're really worth paying attention to and really quite fascinating. Okay, so we've set the table plate, spring is in the air, and now, finally, those of you who said that you would start your Haggadah with the order, finally get some satisfaction. The very first example of that comes from the year 1609 in an early printed Haggadah from Venice. Now, that's not to say that the idea of the simanim, of the signs, of the order, only comes from 1609. It goes to the, it goes back at least to the 12th century, 12th or 13th century, but for whatever reason, no artist ever decided to do it. I see Glow has made the point that yes, in the Seder plate of the Moshe Prupes example, the symbols are missing. It's true, the symbols are missing. The words are there. Do you need the symbols? I don't know. It's a, you know, it's a matter of taste or choice. But it's certainly, I think, fair to say it's one of the, you know, we have to be flexible when it comes to looking at these kibbutz Haggadot. Okay, so back to the order. So there is the Venice Haggadah, the very first one that put them all on the same page with pictures. And here another mid-20th century Israeli version, the so-called Yavne Haggadah, which again, I think is not only very beautiful in its kind of Art Deco, Art Nouveau style, but also by including these winged angels, for me, and certainly around this rectangular thing that looks like a box or a shield, it reminds me of the kruvim, of the cherubim on the tabernacle. Now, do I know for a fact that that's what Tzvi Livni, the artist, was thinking of? I do not have any such evidence, but this is an example of how it stimulates me to think of something. And, you know, now all of a sudden I'm thinking about, the tabernacle and the Mishkan and in the desert and the Jews. And, you know, it's stimulated me to have a whole chain of associations that I wouldn't have without those pictures. Okay, here, another one of those Iberian Haggadot from the 14th century. This one, once again, we have the preparation for the Seder. The people are sitting at the table. The thing that attracts my attention is the full page of text on the left with the man very prominently pouring the wine. And here's an example where we've got the main text, which are basically, it's both stage directions for pouring the wine. It's the actual text of the bracha, Yabore Pri Hagafen. And there's also Perush on the very top and the very bottom. Right in here, I'm just giving you a close up. I still don't know if it's clear enough to read, but the text says, right? Adam chayav lishtot arba kosot b'leil rishon shel Pesach keneged, and here's the text here, keneged arba'a gulot shektobot b'torah shehem b'hotzeiti v'tzalti v'lakachti v'galti, right? And it goes on and explains the four expressions, and this is basic Perush interpretation that we associate with the four cups and the four expressions of redemption. Sometimes these commentaries come solely in the form of pictures, as in this example of a Haggadah that I don't expect anyone has ever seen. I just happened to buy it as part of a lot of 100. And I was fascinated by the fact that a Haggadah published in Warsaw in 1924 has English in it. And so they clearly made it for the export market. They knew it was going to go over to the New World. So here we are, Kadesh. We're finally going to get to drink our first cup of wine. Baruch Atah Hashem, Alkeinu Melech Haolam, Barei Pri HaGafen. We drink. But on the page in this Haggadah, we see Rosh Paro, Ramses HaSheni. This is the head of the Pharaoh, Ramses II. It's a little archaeological snippet. Keep in mind that 1924 is just a year or so after Howard Carter dug up the tomb of Tutankhamun, so Egypt mania was rampant throughout the world. And then in the bottom, we have a picture of a crowned fellow in a bucket. Paro nitztara v'rachatz b'dmei yodei Yisrael. Pharaoh is leprous, and he washed in the blood of the Israelite children. Whoa, what's that all about? So as an art historian, my first instinct is to say, where does this picture come from? Now, I know people like Rabbi Kelman are saying, oh, I know that that text is from a Midrash, which I'm going to show you in a moment. So for me, I start by looking at the picture, and I see that, in fact, this Warsaw Haggadah literally copies an engraving that appeared originally in that early printed Venice Haggadah of 1609. But what's interesting is that that image of Pharaoh bathing in Venice 1609 was part of the Magid section, the toils and tribulations of the Israelites. I just take the opportunity to show another more crisp image from the Venice Haggadah. And so over there, what's the pshat? The interpretation is that when the king of Egypt died, according to Exodus chapter 2, Rashi comes along and tells us, well, he didn't actually die, but he became leprous. And he cites the Midrash, the homiletic teaching, that explains why leprosy is considered death, and that the cure suggested by the Egyptian magicians, physicians, was to bathe in the blood of the Jewish children, which is what was one of the torments of the Jews in Egypt. Okay, so I understand why I would put such a picture in the Magid section. It's the suffering of the Jews. But why in Warsaw 1924, does it end up on Kadesh? Because you have to go to the Gemara, Tractate Pesachim 108b, where they talk about the various characteristics of the wine, and they cite the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, who says Terayin ki etadam. Don't look upon the wine when it's red. Okay, so what? So in a commentary on the Gemara, the Or Zarua from the 13th century, as far as I know, is the first commentator to make the link, who here at the very end of the commentary says, "V'gam yayin adam zachar l'dvar shaya paro shalchei tinokot kishenitzara," that the red wine is also meant to make you think of the blood of the Jewish children that Pharaoh bathed in his leprous state. And so the Warsaw is the Warsaw Haggadah page is juxtaposing that moment from the Venice Haggadah in Kadesh to help us make the point that the Or Zarua made 600 years previously. So it's just one example, and this is probably the one that I'm going to expand upon the most. I'm going to go back to more of a overview in a moment, but I wanted to spend a little time exploring one picture in more depth, just to show all the layers that are underlying these pictures, that if you were to open the Warsaw Haggadah of 1924, or any other for that matter, you would simply look at this picture and you'd go, "Oh, okay, that's interesting. That's weird. I wonder what that's about. All right, let's go on, because you know people are anxious to get to the meal." But I hope that this demonstrates, you know, how far one can dig textually and visually to understand what's going on in this particular picture. Okay, now, are we ready to move on? No, not yet. What if the first Seder comes Motzei Shabbat, as it does this year? Very timely. So you can learn in Pesachim, and as Rabbi Kelman said, we've just finished off Yomi on Pesachim. Everyone's got all of the details about Pesach firmly in their head. So you all likely know about the different disputes about what the order is when you have to say Kiddush for Pesach on Saturday night, when you also have to say Havdalah. So you could write it as a text. You could go to dafachayim.org and get this very nice diagram that breaks down the different opinions. Or you could do what the artist Joel Ben Shimon did back in 1460, where he used the acronym Yud-Kuf Nun-Hei-Zayin, Yak-Nahaz, which translates into Yiddish, hunt the hares, and you can illustrate the page with a picture of the hunt of the rabbit. Now, this by now is fairly well known, so I won't dwell any more on it. Okay, Orchatz, Karpas, I have nothing to say about them, but I didn't want them to feel left out. So here are two pictures from a 18th century copy of the Venice Haggadah. Onward, Yachatz, break the middle matzah. Here, an Iberian example, I'll make it nice and big. So much going on here, but the Svardim in the crowd will recognize right away what's going on. The yes, Ellen. Most of them, not all. We're breaking the matzah, and the wife is putting it in a pouch and she's going to hide it, and presumably the kids are going to steal it. Again, this is another one of those examples where those who are interested in the history of Minhag can use these to track what was done when. Okay, Abba 100 didn't understand hunting the hare. Let me go back. I went over it rather quickly. The Talmud generates a mnemonic, the abbreviation of the five different things you have to do in the particular order. So you say Borei Pri HaGafen, then you say Asher Bar HaBanu, then you say Borei Morei HaEsh, then you say Borei Mnes, then you say Hamavi Megan the Shechol, and then you say Shachianu. Right? And if you take the first letters of those different components in Hebrew, it combines to form an abbreviation, Yak Nahaz, which I've transliterated here. If you live in Germany in the 15th century and you're a Yiddish speaker and you hear the word Yak Nahaz, it sounds like a German Yiddish phrase you know, Yag Nahaz, or hunt the hare. And so what Joel Ben Simeon does is at the bottom of that page where all of those things are happening textually, he gives you a visualization of that abbreviation with a hunter leading the pack of dogs who are after the rabbit. Now, it's also likely that that rabbit is also symbolic of the Jewish people and the hunter of the non-Jews who oppress the Jews, that's fairly well accepted among scholars, but it goes into different directions. So just move right along. Okay, so we've broken the middle matzah. What's next? Magid, right? You're saying we haven't even gotten to Magid yet. Oh my goodness. But we still haven't gotten to Magid because here's one of those examples of a kibbutz Haggadah. I just love this page. It was one of those surprising things. Hareini muchan umizuman l'kayem ha-mitzvah l'saperi b'tziat Mitzrayim yachad im kol Yisrael. You know, I've been attending Seders for well over 50 years. I've never heard this formula in any Seder. And, you know, it's the kibbutz setting, you know, it's not what you would expect. It's certainly not what I expected, but it's a beautiful idea. So let us now, with the merry members of Kibbutz HaShita, let us finally enter into Magid. Now, Magid, obviously, the telling of the Haggadah is the heart, and there are countless illustrations, and these are going to go by so fast, and I apologize for that, but I want to thank Ellen for reminding me to say, most of these pictures are taken from my book with all kinds of writing on the subject. So, you know, if you miss anything or you're stimulated, go buy the book and you'll get all of these pictures and more. Okay, Halach Ma'anya, this is the bread of affliction. I chose three examples, each showing something a little different. This example, the so-called Rothschild Machzor from Florence, 1490, is exquisite. It is one of the finest illustrated books you could possibly imagine being made for anybody in Italy in the late 15th century. And it was made for a Haggadah. So, you know, it's kind of ironic that, you know, this is the bread of affliction appears in a luxurious manuscript that reminds us that in the Middle Ages, in the Renaissance, although Jews suffered plenty, not all of them did. Many of them, some did quite well. Okay, unfortunately, that's not the case for the Omza Haggadah, which was made in Budapest in 1942. If you just think about the historical moment, it breaks your heart. And here, I can't resist the opportunity to stick in the Maxwell House Haggadah, another Haggadah from my childhood, with the, you know, father knows best American family. Hamevin Yavin. Okay, we're going to whip through Magid, right? Because we got to get to the meal. The Four Sons, arguably the most popular subject for illustration. One could literally do an entire semester just exploring the Four Sons. I'll show you two examples. This medieval example is interesting insofar as you can see that the Chacham, of course, is a wise, bearded, clearly not a son. The wise child is a learned figure who points to the open book. He's literate. The Rasha is a soldier with a bloody sword. He's got a blue pigment. He might be a Berber. He's certainly not one of us. So there's a clear othering here. But even beyond that, it looks like somebody, I don't know if it was the year the thing was made, 10 years later, 50 years later, they've kind of smudged out the face of the Rasha. It's a kind of iconoclasm, a kind of defacing, literally defacing of the wicked person to diminish his power. More modern is the Steinhardt Haggadah, where the Rasha is once again a soldier, this time a Prussian soldier, a German soldier from World War I. Steinhardt himself had served in World War I, and one gets a sense of the horrors of that conflict in this picture. Mithrila, originally our ancestors were idol worshippers. Somebody picked that as a place to start the Haggadah, certainly early on in Magid. Here's an example that tries to take it literally. Idol worshippers, I'm going to show you a Canaanite idol and remind you of what was going on in that part of the world in the time of the ancestors. Okay, now we have all the verses. Va'ekachet avichem et Avraham me'ever hanar. I took Abraham from over the river. The Mantua Haggadah is pretty modest. By the time of this 18th century Haggadah, Abraham's ship to cross the Euphrates has become quite remarkable, but it leads him to the moment of the three angels where Abraham and Sarah give them hospitality, and that's going to announce the birth of Isaac. I'll come back to the ship. I just want to get through a little more Magid. Here, the images of Isaac, Jacob. Here's the part beneath the covenant, the covenant between the parts, the Brit Ben Haptarim. And I love this picture of Isaac because I hope you can see that he's wearing eyeglasses. There's a very early representation of eyeglasses in art. And again, it's a kind of Perush. It's a midrash. It's like, why does Isaac wear glasses? Because Isaac was old and is infirm and couldn't see. And then there's the whole thing with Isaac and Jacob, Yaakov and Esav, Jacob and Esau, right? So again, just a little any teensy weensy detail that brings a whole story to mind. So you got to look carefully to see all the cues that the artists are giving you. Go and learn what Laban, the Aramean, did to Jacob. I'm going to skip that one. Okay, Vinitzak, they cried out. Now you can do it traditionally like the Venice Haggadah did with just showing the Israelites, whoops, sorry about that. You can see the Israelites working hard, toiling, or like Agam more recently, this very abstract page, just orange and what's this color? Look at me, some art historian I am. This kind of violety color, simple representation of the eye, firm geometric lines, but through this simple composition, he creates the sense of the mouth opening wide and calling out in pain. It's, I think, very effective. More verses from Magid, both of which insert Moshe into the story. Right here, the finding of Moshe in the Nile by Pharaoh's daughter, and here Moses leading the people away from the pursuing Egyptians. The Otto Geismar Haggadah, Berlin, 1927, absolutely delightful. And again, another demonstration of how much an artist can convey, even with simple lines. 10 plagues. Wow, that would need another lecture. Everyone's got their own favorite 10 plagues. I love this scene from Sarajevo Haggadah, which tries to give visual expression to the Midrash about the darkness that plagued the Egyptians. But meanwhile, at the same time, and this is part of the miracle, the Jews had light. And we know that they had light because they can read their books. Lovely. I put some of these in just like this one. You know, how many plagues were there? 50, 100, 150, right? You'd say, how could you possibly illustrate that? Avner Mariah and Izzy Plodwinski, who did the calligraphy, they found a way. Mostly, this is a way for me to say, if you're looking for wonderful Haggadot, think about the Mariah Haggadah, the Moss Haggadah, the Mariah Haggadah. They're fantastic. Okay, here's a big point. And then I'll try and go quickly through the rest. These pictures from Dayenu, which show people dressed as 16th century Venetians or 18th century Middle Europeans, right? Clearly, right, with a horse and buggy, horse-drawn carriages, centuries with muskets, right? Obviously, they are not historically accurate. Now, we can chuckle and say, ha, 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 oh, they didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know what life was like back in ancient Egypt. And that's probably true. They didn't know it as archaeologically as we do. But in a way, that would be to miss the point. Because what artists like Joseph and David of Leipzig were trying to do was make the story vivid, to make it approachable so that the viewer of the Haggadah would connect with the events and be pulled in and be able to see themselves as if they themselves were part of the story, which, of course, we know is a passage in the Haggadah. Which I'm going to skip to very quickly because I'm keenly aware of the fact that I'm almost at 1 hour and I do want to make sure I get through the Haggadah. So I'm going to start skipping things rather dramatically. All right, so Rabban Gamliel says you have to mention Pesach, Matz, and Maror. I'll just focus on Maror, which is... in this Haggadah made right after the Shoah in a displaced persons camp in Munich in 1946 is just absolutely terrible. I won't say more about that. In the medieval example on the right, this is one of many examples where the husband and the wife have at it. The husband holds up the maror and he says, this is the cause of my bitterness, which is basically a play on Kohelet, Ecclesiastes 7:26, where it says, Umotzani mar mimaves et ha'isha asher hi mitzodim b'charamim liba. Asurim Yadeha, right? That it's the woman is as bitter as death. And so he holds up the maror and he says, you see, you're bitter to me like this maror. But in this particular example, I love the fact that the wife gets the last word because she points back and says, I thought you were the cause of bitterness. So I think there are all kinds of layers there. You do with it what you want. Here we find that phrase, b'chol dor v'dor, chayav adam lirot et atzmo, everyone should see themselves. And here David Moss has literally set mirrors into the page so that you can see yourself. And he also alternates with historical figures leading from the ancient past to the modern day. Lefichach, therefore, we should raise a glass and finally get to all the ritual bits. And Baruch Hashem, thank God, we're finally at the meal where everyone's dressed in their great finery. They're spilling things on the page. So, you know, here's good excuse. If you do it, know that Jews have been doing it for hundreds of years. Okay, we finished the meal. Sorry to rush you through the meal, but we have to get to the afikomen. And we have this wonderful modern image in which, again, I would love to talk you through it, but I'm conscious of the time. You can see, I think, pretty clearly that the room is upside down. Also, the guy's got his face and his torso, and the kid doesn't have a face. It's a weird picture. And I think that the artist, Gerard Garoust, is making a point about the strangeness of Afikomen, right? The idea that you have to steal the Afikomen, or you have to hide it and the children have to find it, or the children steal it and hold it for ransom, right? It's, I mean, who ever heard of such a custom and such a thing, right? Imagine, I always like to say, imagine if you had a custom where kids stole the etrog before lulav and etrog. You'd say you're crazy, right? And that, I think that's what Garusta is saying, that this kind of weird thing before Afikomen, and his picture sensitizes us to the strangeness of this custom and makes us think about it. Okay, it's time to bench. Just some gorgeous examples. I'm not going to say anything more about them because we have to pour out our wrath. Oy, such a problematic thing, which Rabbi Matthew Berkowitz struggles with and turns the cup of Elijah on its head. And he puts in the quote, Nachamu, Nachamu, Ami. He hopes that we can have conciliation. It's a beautiful thought. You know, Hallel, you know, I feel like this is the Seder. You know, after we've eaten the meal, we get to the second half, like everybody just wants to run through. So I'm just going to run through Hallel. Nishmat, Kol Chai, there you go. All the birds, all the animals are singing in praise of God. Barry Eifker, all my bones shall speak. Okay. Now, finally, and I'm going to do this if you can give me 5 more minutes, and I promise I will stay as long as people want to ask questions, answer questions, have a conversation. If you give me 5 more minutes, I will get through to the end of the presentation proper. Okay, we finally come to the end. You know, and it's always the case, just when you think you're at the end of the Seder, there's one more thing. Right, so here is Azrov Nisim, which I just love the fact that here you've got two examples from 500 years apart, and they choose exactly the same image in this whole poetic text. There are many, many episodes, right? But what the artist of the Rothschild miscellany pulled out is Jacob wrestling with the angel. And that's what Moshe Prupes does later in 1961 in what I think is just such a spectacularly beautiful picture. Okay, finally. Now here, Lashana Haba B'Yushalayim, Nirtza, it's the last formal thing of the Seder. And I picked two examples that I think express the feeling of many people literally in this moment and at the end of the Seder, right? We've come to the end. We fulfilled everything according to the precepts, et cetera, et cetera. And in the Florsheim Haggadah, right? Here's the family. They're finishing up the last cup of wine. Now, if you think about it, the artist could have just done that, just shown the family at the table, but the artist expands the field so that we see the promise of the bed waiting to welcome the people at the end of the Seder. In the Geismar Haggadah, the poor person is just literally dropped asleep at the table itself. So those of you who feel like you've finished the Seder, you're welcome to leave, but as many of you know, there's always more. We've got to sing Adir Hu, praise be to God, and we pray for the restoration of the temple. This gives me an opportunity to show you the Amsterdam Haggadah of 1695, the first one printed with the use of copper plate engravings, which was just a technological revolution. Echad mi yodea, who knows one? Well, again, you could do it the old-fashioned way, right? Where you can say, five are the books of the Torah, six is the Mishnah, seven is Shabbat, eight is the Mila, the circumcision. Okay, and again, nice snapshots of 18th century life. Or you can go for the modern take, Dan Reisinger. I love this geometric formulation and the idea that it's a pyramid, but it all rests on God who is one. Technically you would think that's not very stable, right? A triangle inverted like that. But we know because of the song that it's rock solid. Okay. And Chad Gadyah, probably the second most popular thing for illustration. Again, I'm just showing you, if I didn't put the Shik Haggadah in somewhere, that I would be sued by the Shik people, because so many of us know and love the Shik Haggadah. And finally, we have an addition in the Kibbutz Haggadot, Hinei Yamim Ba'im, this beautiful passage from the prophet Amos, which talks about the restoration of Israel, which is illustrated so beautifully in some of these Haggadot. I just wanted to bring that to your attention. But the idea of adding something at the end to emphasize Israel. I Nefesh B'Nefesh should be sponsoring this lecture. Already in 1695, the Amsterdam Haggadah added a fold-out map of the Exodus. And as it says, to make known to every understanding person the route of the 40-year journey in the desert and the breadth and length of the Holy Land, from the river of Egypt to the city of Damascus, from the valley of Arnon to the Great Sea, and within it, the appointed domain of each tribe. And there are all kinds of details on the page that bring out additional layers of meaning. But it seems to me that this is finally, we've gotten to the back cover of the Amsterdam Haggadah. We've literally traveled from the beginning of creation to the Exodus that brings us finally into the promised land. And so much in between. I know I've spoken quickly and I skip things, and I thank you for your patience in bearing with me and seeing it through to the end. And again, I'm happy to stay here and look at chat, go through chat, or people can unmute themselves. That's fine too, whatever's easiest. So I'm going to keep the share on in case we want to go back. I'll keep my screen up in case we want to go back and look at any pictures, but I'll formally bring things to a close and end by wishing you all a Chag Sameach. Please, everyone, no matter where you are, stay safe, stay sane, and have a wonderful, meaningful Passover. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to take a quick look in the chat. I'm sure I missed all kinds of things. And Rabbi Kelman had to go teach, so he couldn't be monitoring the chat to keep me... Yes, Barry Ivker. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Oh my, Marsh has asked me a question about visual art and brain and the limbic center, and this gets into cognitive psychology, which is so far beyond my abilities that I'm hesitant to say anything about that, except, again, I think one of the clear things, okay, what I hope to have communicated is that the pictures work on many layers. They are connected to texts, but they are not themselves texts. They appeal to different senses. They stimulate different emotions. And in that way, I think, you know, there is something having to do with psychology going on there, but I don't have the technical language for communicating that accurately. So I will just stop there. Okay. Ellen, I only see just a couple more comments. I'm going to respond to each and every one of them. Let me go back quickly. I got so many things going on my screen. Just bear with me. Here we go. So the question here was, Ellen says, most of the Haggadah pics are black and white, but there's one from later that was colored. Right. So to make a long story short, the Venice Haggadah, the Amsterdam Haggadah, those were reprinted over and over and over and over again in black and white. But occasionally, some people wanted a fancier version. They wanted a handmade edition of the Haggadah. So they hired individuals to make them. Now, most of these individuals were themselves not great artists. So what they did is they simply took the Venice Haggadah and they took the Amsterdam Haggadah and they copied them freehand, but they just, you know, they did a cover version, as we would say in modern terms. And so they simply copied them. They made slight alterations, but they did so and did them in color so that they would be more of a luxury handmade one-off edition for a particular well-to-do patron. So Ellen, I hope that answers your question. And there are dozens of such examples. Marilyn Mandel. There's always one Marilyn Mandel. I don't know if Marilyn is still with us. There's always one in every group. Oh, Marilyn is still there, right? She wants to know what I make of the bird's head Haggadah. Marilyn noticed that I went out of my way not to show the bird's head Haggadah because I didn't want to answer that question because it's a really hard question. So Marilyn, here's my email. I didn't put it on the last one. Here's my email. Send me an email. We can talk about the bird's head Haggadah offline.
Okay.
Some more comments. Oh, this is not a question, but of course I have to read this one. Bought your book last year, enjoyed it then, and we'll be reading it again this Yom Tov. Thank you. Thank you, Lisa. Chaim Nachum Sarna states that Ramses II was the most likely candidate. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. God bless you, Michael, whoever you are. Yes. Irv makes mention of the fact that it's cool that we know the identity of some of the artists. Absolutely. And, you know, that's one of the things that keeps art historians like me in business, is the hunt for more information and additional knowledge about the particular artists. And, you know, we spend a lot of time arguing, you know, who did this, and was it this artist? Was it that artist? Was the artist Jewish? Was the artist not Jewish? Sometimes it's clear one way, sometimes it's clear the other way. Often it's a matter of great debate. To what degree, you know, again, some big art historical questions. To what degree is what we see on the page the product of the artist's intentions or the desires of the patron, the person who's paying the artist, or some combination thereof, right? And that's something I didn't get into at all. I just presented the material sort of flat on the page saying, this is what it means. But of course, like so much, and I guess here I'll kind of try and come up with a summary statement that the despite my protest, pictures are in many ways like texts insofar as once they go on the page and once they go out into the world, then they're subject to consumption by everyone. And we spend our time looking and thinking and reading and connecting, and it becomes the raw material for additional ideas and additional learning. And my whole goal is simply to add another ingredient to your chalent, so that when you're thinking about the Seder, the Haggadah, that you consider the possibility that the pictures in some of the Haggadahs that you might have lying around the home could add additional layers of meaning and appreciation for the Seder. I would be happy to end there. That sounds like as good a concluding statement as I could manage. But again, if anyone has burning issues, I encourage you, you have my email now. I'm happy to be in contact with anybody for any reason. And if I miss somebody's question or comment, I apologize. Anyone at all? Anyone at all? Yeah. Who is this? Who is this?
You want to give some family stories at your theater?
Who is Ari Cohen? I want you to know we're being recorded here. So I think, but before we before anybody gets embarrassed, we will.
I got nothing to be sorry about. No bad stories about me at the theater.
I knew I shouldn't have told my family about this event. Okay. Thank you all so very much for your patience and your determination to see it through the end. Like the family in the Florsheim Haggadah, I encourage you all, especially if you're in Israel, right? Go to your comfy beds.